Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. The nation awoke today to the stunning news that President Trump and First Lady Melania Trump have tested positive for COVID-19. This comes after the presidential debate on Tuesday and the president's appearance at Harrisburg International Airport this week. The president's health will be many Americans' main concern, but with an election just a month away, one has to wonder if this will have any kind of impact. On today's program, we're joined by Dr. John Goldman. He's an infectious disease specialist at UPMC to talk more about the virus, crowds, mask wearing. Dr. Goldman, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
If you have a question or comment, we're going to be talking a lot about the virus itself and not just the president's diagnosis. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Now, this note, Republican incumbent Congressman Lloyd Smucker was scheduled to be on today's show. Congressman Smucker was called back to Washington, so we will reschedule his appearance on Smart Talk. Dr. Goldman, I'm going to try my best not to get you to speculate on the president's health, but to talk about some of the factors that could have led to he and the First Lady contracting the disease and answering some general questions as we've done in the past about COVID-19. Sure. So with all that said, this is probably a speculative question, but with the president being around so many people at rallies, at, even the debate earlier this week, Hope Hicks, one of his communications people, tested positive earlier this week. Can we say it's a surprise that the president and the first lady have contracted the virus?
We absolutely can say it's a surprise. The president and his staff and all the people around him are tested every day. And so what this, I believe, illustrates is this is a fairly cunning and fairly infectious virus. So even though everyone was being tested, it sounds like Hope Hicks, who may have had closer contact with the president, had symptoms, was positive for COVID. And unfortunately, most people are infectious for 24 to 48 hours before they become symptomatic. Many people are asymptomatic and are infectious when they don't even know they're sick. The tests they're using aren't perfect. They, as I understand it, use an antigen testing system that gives you very rapid results, but the trade-off for those rapid results is that it's a little less accurate than some of the PCR tests that, for example, we use in the hospital. And the good thing about it, those, is you can test a lot of people quickly. The bad is you miss a few cases. And what I think happened is someone who probably was pre-symptomatic, was about to get sick, tested negative, kind of slipped through the cracks, and ended up exposing the president. So I think it is surprising that someone who has so much testing, someone who has so much thought and effort putting into keeping him safe, that the virus manages to get through this testing, these efforts. And I think what it really illustrates for the rest of us is this is a very infectious virus. And it illustrates for the rest of us that we really do have to be careful. We really do have to social distance. And my firm belief is that by wearing masks, we can prevent it. I think we've discussed in the past that at UPMC Pinnacle, we basically eliminated this kind of transmission by having everyone in the hospital mask basically at all times.
There are people around the country who are saying this should be a wake-up call for all Americans, that if you weren't paying attention to the virus or not taking the virus seriously or not wearing a mask, that if the President of the United States and the First Lady can contract the virus, it should say to all Americans, this is how contagious that this virus is. Would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. I would say that we have unfortunately had a number of previous wake-up calls. So, for example, if you look at what happened when we reopened the country, we went from about 20, 30,000 cases a day up to over 70,000 during the summer. If you look at many places where they reopened, many states where they reopened, in my opinion, too quickly, we had a pretty quick increase in the number of cases. What we've seen over and over again is that this is a very infectious virus, and that unless we take precautions, unless we social distance, it infects people. And what this illustrates is probably one of the most, if not the most powerful men in the world, who has daily testing of everyone who comes in contact with him, still ends up infected. It illustrates for many of us, I certainly don't walk into work and get tested every day. It illustrates for many of us who have lower levels of precaution that we have to be careful.
We just got a headline that CNN is reporting that the president is showing minor symptoms of the virus. Earlier, the White House physician was not giving a whole lot of information, just saying that the president and first lady were doing well, without getting into too many specifics. Now, again, this hasn't been confirmed, but CNN reporting that the president is showing minor symptoms. And again, some of these things we can't count on that everyone listening today has heard us in the past, Dr. Goldman, but we have talked about this before, that it would seem to be especially dangerous, if you will, or have the potential for spreading the disease, if someone is not showing symptoms and they feel confident that they're healthy and have not been exposed to the disease. Would you agree with that?
I think one of the things that has been difficult with this virus is there are a lot of people who have minor symptoms who are clearly infectious. So I've had the experience of talking to someone who only has minor symptoms of sore throat, what I think is just the common cold, thinking to myself, this is not going to be COVID. They just simply aren't sick enough. And then finding out that they, in fact, have COVID. So part of the problem is that there is a great range in the way this disease presents. There are, I think, if you 80% of the people have minor symptoms that could be mistaken for the common cold or a slight case of the flu, one of the things that's currently being worked out is how infectious they are. But people who have minor to no symptoms clearly can be infectious, and in the hospital, if we're doing contact tracing, if we're tracing to see who someone with COVID could have infected, we assume that they were infectious for roughly 48 hours before they got symptoms. So people with minor symptoms can minor or no symptoms can clearly spread the disease. It's often controversial about how effective they are at spreading the disease, but they can clearly spread it.
The president at rallies with maybe 1,000, I'm not sure the exact attendance, Harrisburg International Airport. Don't know if, I think he tested negative that day. But with contact tracing and that many people at a rally, obviously very few were within 6 feet of the president. I mean, does it make sense that there will be contact tracing, that people who attended that rally should maybe quarantine, get tested? I mean, I don't know if we've had a precedent for this where there's been someone who has been at a large event with so many people. What do you think about that? I mean, does it even make sense?
Well, what I would do, first of all, is take a step back and try to look at this objectively. So I would take a step back and say, okay, what would I do if this wasn't the president, if there weren't so many headlines involved? And how would I recommend that people do testing, tracing, et cetera? The first thing I would do is note that I believe it was an outdoor rally.
Yes,
which
it was.
Much lower risk. If you think about it, if someone is transmitting COVID, if you're in a room, if you're in an area where the air just sits there, the levels of the virus are likely to build up much higher than if you're an outdoor rally where the virus is literally likely to be blown away or will literally just go off into the air. Second of all, almost no one was within 6 feet for more than 15 minutes, which is what we use as the standard for who we consider a high-risk exposure. Finally, at least when I've seen pictures of the rally, the people who were closest to the president were masked. So they were clearly at lower risk. I believe that people who are at a rally like that, I would personally recommend what's called self-monitoring, meaning if they get symptoms in the next 2 weeks, 2 weeks from the rally, they talk to their provider and they consider testing. But let's take a step back. I believe that rally, because it was outdoors, because there were relatively few people within 6 feet of the president, that was a low-risk event. I don't believe that it was a completely no-risk event, but I'm not sure that anything these days is a no-risk event.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. President Trump and First Lady Melania Trump tested positive for COVID-19. The news came out this morning. We're talking with Dr. John Goldman, infectious disease specialist at UPMC Pinnacle. Not asking him to speculate on the president's health per se, but some of the issues surrounding COVID-19 and the president, rallies, the people who have been around the president. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. And something I want to repeat also, Republican incumbent Congressman Lloyd Smucker was scheduled to be on today's show. Congressman Smucker was called back to Washington, so we will reschedule his appearance on Smart Talk. We are interviewing candidates before the November 3rd election. We have an email here from a listener. Dr. Goldman says, I do not think that it is a surprise that the president is now positive for COVID. He would not wear a mask or social distance. In fact, he ridiculed anyone who did those things. Ask if he was a mask user, he would be risk less. Now, let me just turn that question around a little bit and also tie it to something you said a little bit earlier about the rally. You said that the people behind the president at that rally at HIA were wearing masks. But the idea behind wearing masks is to protect other people, not to keep you, that person wearing the mask, from getting the virus. So how would those people behind the president wearing masks be any less susceptible than though only because other people are wearing masks, or what?
Well, we're oversimplifying it. So you have to remember, when you do a public health intervention, you are decreasing risk. And the biggest decrease in risk is if two people are wearing masks. You still do a great decrease in risk, not only to other people, but to yourself, if you're wearing a mask. It does clearly depend a bit on what type of mask you're wearing. So, for example, a cloth mask is much better at protecting other people. A surgical mask is much better at both protecting other people and yourself. So the people behind him were wearing masks. I frankly couldn't tell if they were cloth or surgical, but they would all be at lower risk because they themselves were wearing a mask, and at lower risk because they were wearing a mask in an outdoor setting where they were not likely to be in contact with a large amount of virus. I will stress that I come into, we at UPMC Pinnacle, we have 30,000 employees. We have three shifts of people coming into seven hospitals. And we insist that everybody wear a mask because we know that when someone gets infected in the community, they don't spread it to their coworkers if everyone is masked. That's hard to do. You know, I have to admit when I'm with people I'm with every day, I try to stay 6 feet away, but when I'm in an office setting, for example, it's kind of hard to always wear a mask with people. But we do strongly believe that masking everyone prevents transmission.
You know, every time you appear on the program, Dr. Goldman, we've had you on several times since the pandemic began. I always ask whether we've learned anything, because this is an ongoing thing. I mean, you think about what we were thinking about the virus back in March and how much we know about it now, but still how little we know about it now. I don't know whether the president being diagnosed again brings even more attention from researchers and that kind of thing. But since even the last time we talked, like 3 weeks ago, anything new in the last 3 weeks?
You know, I think that we're learning about this all the time. I think that you can see that we have learned how to take care of the virus, patients with the virus, much better. I think we're learning that we can decrease the mortality. Clearly, it's been documented that steroids work. They decrease the mortality 20% in mild patients, 30% in severe patients. My clinical impression, and that's a code word for I can't back this up with evidence, is that the combination of steroids and remdesivir greatly decreased the mortality. We certainly see fewer patients in the intensive care unit. We certainly see fewer, not none, fewer patients who are dying. And I think that the president getting sick illustrates how we all have to be careful. This is one of the most protected men in the world, and the virus still got through to him. Most of us don't have that level of protection, which means that most of us have to be very careful. Most of us have to take precautions. I think that when you're out in public, most of us have to wear a mask. I certainly do.
We had a listener who asked, or actually made a comment saying that just daily testing alone is not enough, that there has to be more to it. It's a process. Is he right?
So I think he is perfectly right, because daily testing tells you that you are not sick now. Daily testing does not tell you that you won't be sick tomorrow, 6 hours from now. Daily testing tells you you're not sick today. Daily testing doesn't tell you you won't be sick tomorrow. And there is also an issue with how accurate the test you're using is. Some of the antigen tests are certainly less sensitive, pick up less infected people than the PCR tests. PCR tests take longer or harder to do or a little more painful. So even if you're being tested daily, the fact that the president got infected illustrates that you still have to be careful.
I had a question here from someone else, wanted to know how long can we expect the president and the first lady to quarantine?
That's a very good question. If you look at both Department of Health and CDC guidelines, in the setting of a mild infection, and I'm going to assume the president has a mild infection, the criteria for return to work based on symptoms is a minimum of 10 days, no fevers for 24 hours without things that reduce your fever, Tylenol, Motrin, and improving symptoms. So assuming that the president is mildly symptomatic, assuming he gets better, the recommendation would be that he be under quarantine for 10 days.
I had a question here from a listener, wanted to know how you can say that the rally was safe when he gives assurances about the president spreading COVID, so the event was relatively safe. Was Trump the only transmitter among those 1,000 people?
I was only addressing the president. I frankly couldn't see the crowd when I looked at it. If you are in a large crowd that has people close together without masks, then there is a higher rate of transmission. At this point, I personally am very careful, and I try to not go to any place where people aren't masking, and I certainly wouldn't go to a large rally where people aren't masking.
The president has been criticized for holding those rallies, even if they're outdoors. He talked about this during the debate Tuesday night, that they've had very few positive cases that have come out of it. Well, the president and the first lady, Hope Hicks, have now tested positive. But those rallies, I mean, you saw many people sitting shoulder to shoulder without mask. I mean, is a gathering like that safe?
I would certainly say that with the level of virus in the United States and with Pennsylvania, I would personally avoid large crowds. If I would avoid large crowds, period, I certainly would avoid large crowds where they're packed together, and I certainly would avoid large crowds where people aren't wearing masks.
Joe Biden stood about 10 feet away from President Trump on Tuesday at that debate. Both of these men are in their 70s. The president is 74. Joe Biden is 77. I understand that Joe Biden is now being, well, at least there's reports that he will be tested. 10 feet apart, stage for an hour and a half. Is Joe Biden in any kind of potential danger of this?
You know, we usually assume that you need to be at least 6 feet apart. Clearly being 10 feet apart is less risky. Joe Biden was there on Tuesday night. It sounds like the president became infected sometime Thursday night, so it's at the borderline of the 48-hour window. The fact that they were relatively close together, 10 feet, the fact that they were together so long clearly puts him at some risk. I would hope that because they were 10 feet, not 6 feet apart, because the president was just at the borderline of that 48-hour window, and I hope they had good air circulation through that venue, I would say that Biden is likely at some risk, although I believe it would be at low risk.
And, you know, that's speculation, and really, that's just your judgment. I mean, we can't really say for sure with some of these things. By the way, Vice President Pence, who was in Lancaster County Tuesday night, has tested negative for the virus as well. So I know you have to run, Dr. Goldman. I want to thank you for agreeing to do this, especially at last minute. with all this said, what kind of advice would you give to our audience out there?
Be careful. This illustrates that we are all still at risk. This illustrates that we all need to take precautions. This illustrates that we all need to social distance. And I believe that if the most protected man in the world, who is tested every day and has everyone around him tested, still gets infected, it illustrates that we all need to wear masks.
Dr. John Goldman is an infectious disease specialist at UPMC Pinnacle. Dr. Goldman, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming up on Monday's Smart Talk, we continue our conversations with candidates. We have two candidates, one running for Auditor General, the other running for Treasurer, both here in Pennsylvania, statewide offices, and that will be coming up on Monday's program. Now, turning to a lot less serious topic at this point, Carlisle is home to illustrator Amy June Bates, who was recently recognized for her work in Gittle's Journey, an Ellis Island story. Bates received a Christopher's Award, National Jewish Book Award, and the Cindy Taylor Honor Award for her full-color illustrations depicting a young girl immigrating alone after a health inspector determines her mother is not well enough to travel. Amy June Bates joins us on today's Smart Talk. Ms. Bates, welcome to the program.
Hello. It's an honor to be here.
Question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalk@witf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So I just had one descriptive sentence about Gittle's Journey and Ellis Island story. Tell us more about Gittle's Journey.
Well, this is a story the author, Leslie Newman, wrote this. It's sort of is a story that is a kind of a combination of her grandmother and her grandmother's best friend's story, who both immigrated to the United States from, I guess as they described it, sometimes it was Russia, sometimes it was Poland, because it was the end of the 1800s, sort of like 1890, 1900, when those borders changed pretty often. And so the real story is a combination of these two girls leaving that country, escaping the violence that was there, and one of them was detained because of her mother had an eye infection, so her mother was not allowed to travel. And that's part of how the Gittle story goes, is that the mother is not allowed to travel with the little girl. So she sends Gittle off on this journey to leave the violence that was in their home country and go to Ellis Island and escape that. And in the book, the mother is reunited in the end with the little girl.
Well, it sounds like a great story, but how do you, as an illustrator, adapt to the story being told in this book?
Oh, I mean, that's such a great question. I love my job. I love reading and, being able to sink into a story, just dive in and sort of really get into the history and sort of how that hits me emotionally and being in the character's shoes and, trying to visualize all of that is great. And when it's a historical project, there's just so much rich information in the Ellis Island, archives and photographs. And it's, just a pleasure to look into all of that and learn more, Part of what I love about my job is I just get to learn a lot.
It sounds like you do a lot of research so that your illustrations are factually correct. Am I correct in assuming that?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not a historian, but I definitely, I don't like to get it wrong. I don't like to be wrong. So I do try to be, as accurate as I can and to get as much information as I can before I, start drawing and painting.
So in this book in particular, what struck you, when you saw photographs, the research that you were doing during that time period on Ellis Island, what struck you, stood out to you and said, this is something that I definitely want to depict in the book?
There was so much. I guess the first thing I would say I was looking at photographs by the photographer Lewis Hines, who was sort of a social reformer photographer, and he, I think also he was a teacher, but he would sort of take his classes to Ellis Island, and he did tons of these great, beautiful, sort of haunting photographs of people there. But what was so interesting to me was, people were traveling from, wherever they were coming from in Europe, and when they got to Ellis Island, they would sort of get off the ship in their best clothes that they had. And what that looked like getting off the ship was whatever ethnic, cultural sort of village, wherever they were coming from, that was their clothing. And so you kind of have this like really rich variety of like textiles and, like if the place you're from sort of has this distinctive fabric, weave, textile, lace hat, people were wearing all that. And it was all just sort of this really interesting mix.
I'm curious how when you're developing a character or the background for a character in a book, how do I ask this question? What's the process? I mean, do you have several versions? Do you just start maybe drawing and saying, I like that, I don't like that, or what's the process itself?
I think, it's probably different for everybody, but for me, I never know where I'm going until I get there. I kind of just what you said, I start going and then kind of your gut says, this is good, this is right. And, the more information I learn, the more I sort of I sort of start grabbing those details kind of like a magpie, I sort of collect all these little bits and
create a nest.
yeah. exactly.
How much input does the book's author, not necessarily just this one, but any book, how much input does the author have?
Well, that, I think it's usually not very much. Let me rephrase that. I think when I get a manuscript, sometimes I'll have some. I've done all kinds of books, lullabies and biographies, and all kinds of things. But if it's a historical book, sometimes I get some historical background. But I actually just really like having a fresh slate. Like, I just have the words. You, the author, are giving me the words, and my job is to visualize that. Or almost, like, I think of it as almost a translation that I'm doing from these words to a visual story. And my job is to sort of make this sort of a visual narrative that goes along with this verbal narrative, if that makes sense. So they, like, it's not just my pictures are telling you exactly what these words are saying. Hopefully they're almost sort of adding this other part of a story that you might not have even seen in the text. It's like what's between the lines, I guess.
You're enriching the story.
Yeah, I hope so. Yeah.
You know, and I'm thinking of a cliche here, and forgive me for a cliche, but a picture is worth a thousand words. Is it?
And I also love, it's like a conversation. You know what I mean? Like you're like the words, the text, they're saying one thing and my visuals are saying something back. Like that it's this play between, hopefully, and that's, those are the best kind of books to me, are these that they both have like this valuable part to play. We're having a conversation right now.
You've been drawing your whole life. How does a person who is skilled and talented at drawing become an illustrator?
I love books just about as much as I love drawing. And so, I think for me, I loved drawing, when you read something that's just like a great visual image or just like really great words and it's inspiring, like that for me is really kind of what greases my wheels. Like I love that. I love words. I love that so much that it's kind of just that play in between the two is what I like. If you're asking, if people want to become an illustrator, I suggest you read a lot of books.
Did you have a favorite book growing up that combined the story and the illustrations in your mind that you looked at and said, I love this?
Oh, gosh, there were so many. I think initially I had this, I would say this is when I was, 7, 8, 9, my dad had a book of the illustrator Howard Pyle, and who was sort of they call the father of American illustration. And in this book of artwork, it sort of had like a little sentence from kind of these exciting stories from the early 1900s, and then the picture that he illustrated next to it. So, for example, it might have a guy hanging on this rope that was between two ships, and then there was somebody else who was hanging on to him, and the text was like, he could only hold on for one more minute, and you don't know, and maybe there was sharks circling underneath. But I love this sort of like, you don't have the rest of the story, you just have this one line. And it just, you spend like an afternoon just thinking, what is going to happen to this guy, hanging from this rope on a ship? So I think that actually is kind of the beginning of what sort of led me to think of what's in these stories or pictures or museums or anything. What's all the story that's happening inside this window, this world?
It's interesting that you think back to your favorites from when you were a young child. From books from the early 1900s, and technology in the last 100 years has changed so much. But it seems as though, even with technology, that taking a pencil, using some color, that those things still resonate with readers or those who are, reading the book and enjoying the illustrations as well. Would you agree with that?
Oh, I do. I think that illustration is really, and books are empathy. It's how we learn about other people and get outside of ourselves, but also really start to understand those things. And, certainly visually, it's just another layer of that. I think before we were writing, we were drawing as human beings. I think it's primitive, really, it's almost really what makes us human, if you want to get right down to it.
Well, that brings up the Christopher Award. It's the Christopher Award salutes media that affirm the highest values of the human spirit. What is it about the illustrations in Gittle's journey that reflect that award's goals?
Well, I like, they have a, I think their the motto of the Christopher Awards is that it's better to light a candle than to curse the darkness, which I think is just a, you know, a beautiful sentiment. I mean, I think that in this book, it sort of has this visual image of lighting a candle and hoping. You know, the whole act of them leaving their home was this act of hope that life could be better. You know, and sometimes you have to make that risk to try to better your life. Otherwise, you know, the darkness just consumes you. But I do think that there's this moment where the mother has to let go of her child and send her. I mean, certainly all of these things have such an emotional resonance to this moment that we are in, like with, you know, child separations at the border and coronavirus, you know, both at the border and, you know, how that separates families and children and, you know, from their loved ones. Certainly, I mean, we are separated from our family right now, meaning personally. But that they sort of hold on to this hope still, you know?
Do you want those who view your illustrations and to read the book, and, you know, maybe any project that you've been involved with, you made the connection with today and why, even though this happened 100 years ago or so, maybe longer than that, that the message is still relevant. I mean, how do you take that into consideration as you're illustrating a book?
Well, when I was illustrating was when, I mean, it was in the fall, and it was basically when we started hearing about the family separations at the border, and it was kind of, I mean, sometimes we do fall in the habit of thinking these are things that happened a long time ago. Mm-hmm. We're not going to do those things now. And it was kind of this terrifying, sad thing that just to see it happening right now. But, you know, that I think is such an important reminder that these things are universal, and we have to remember that. Hopefully reading the book can give kids like this understanding of what children that are separated from their families could be feeling.
You illustrate children's books primarily. Anything else? By the way, your portfolio, we have on our website, linked to our webpage, WITF.org/smarttalk. But children's books primarily. Anything else?
I do. I'm an artist. I paint. I love Pennsylvania landscape, and I do a lot of that. We are kind of outdoors quite a bit, and that's sort of a... But I paint, you know, and I draw, just, you know, whatever is on my mind. But I do, I mostly do books, yeah. I've done quite a few. I think maybe even 60 at this point.
That many?
Oh. Yeah.
So you're prolific at it. I'm curious, is there a place or places in central Pennsylvania that are your favorites to paint?
Yeah, I mean, well, it changes all the time, but this year I've painted, we've sort of been figuring out new ways to experience the outside. So we got kayaks, and we were, so the Cana de Gwinnett, which is kind of in and around, you know, Carlisle area. So I painted there a bit, and up in the Grand Canyon, and the Pennsylvania Grand Canyon. Mm-hmm. Although I am from the West originally, so I do paint, in Utah quite a bit. And I guess I just really love rivers this year. I think it's it's what I'm really interested in.
You know, I just yesterday on our program, we were talking about how the arts have been impacted during the pandemic. I stated something, you tell me, but it seems as though this was an observation on my part, that when the pandemic first started, the art that I saw, a lot of it was dark. A lot of it was, you know, people were sad. People were isolated.
Yeah.
But in the last few months, it hasn't been. It's been, if you want to describe it some way, it's that the art has been full of hope. Have you observed that too?
Oh, I think so. I mean, I think we're all processing this, you know, and in a weird way, we are connected by this processing that's probably pretty, like, there's just a, like, sort of a human approach to that. I definitely think, I mean, I think it's really been, I mean, we'll always love seeing artwork, and I think it can be such a way of sort of really empathizing and feeling what somebody else can feel. I've noticed a huge uptick in sort of online art, sort of this whole art world of connected, you know, conversations. And I mean, I think that right now, probably the political situation is really stressful for a lot of people, but that there's also this sense of, you know, keep your chin up, you know, because that's the way you get through it, right?
And I wanted to mention this before we have about 2 minutes left in the program. You collaborated with Dr. Jill Biden. Tell us about how those images developed.
Well, that was an interesting project for sure. That was happening right when the pandemic started. And for my kids, I've got three kids, I think sort of for them to see kind of the different, I know this sounds weird, but he lived this kind of idyllic childhood that is sort of different to kids today. I mean, he was, you know, outside and had this freedom, and especially right now in the pandemic, like, you know, kind of going around doing these great things as a kid, having a lot of fun. And life is somehow different. It's changed, you know, in the years since that was the case. For this generation, I think there's a lot more pressure and a lot less time. And I think some of that is coming around, but there has been less freedom for kids to just sort of hang out and go outside. And
now, what was the project with Dr. Biden?
Oh, I'm sorry. It was the biography of Joe Biden.
Oh,
called
Joe Biden.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you did. So you did the illustrations on that.
I did. Yeah.
Oh, you did. I want to thank Amy June Bates from Carlisle, award-winning illustrator, for being with us today. Great conversation. I appreciate you being on the program today. And if people are not familiar with your work, they probably are with 60 different books, but go to our website, WITF.org/smarttalk, to see your portfolio. Ms. Bates, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Thank you. Coming up on Monday, we will continue our conversations with candidates on the November 3rd ballot, a candidate for Auditor General and a candidate for Treasurer. That's coming up on Monday's program, so be sure to tune in.